Let's just pray before we start into this book of Esther. Gracious God, as we open your word, open our hearts. Illuminate your word by your spirit and show us Jesus. Amen. Once upon a time is one of those lines, isn't it, that never goes out of fashion. It has stood the test of time, and many a parent and grandparent has delighted to snuggle up with the little ones and go on an adventure once upon a time. Why do we do that? Is it tradition? Maybe it's about safety and comfort, that those old stories reassure us, don't they, that everything will be okay in the end. Everything will be all right. And as you and I would sit here this morning, we know all too well there's a lot to threaten that safety and comfort. Hope today could be squished very easily. We've all heard more than enough about COVID by this time to last a lifetime. But it's still a worry, isn't it? We have folks who've come back to church, gone back to school or work, but there are plenty who haven't yet. Safety, worry, the need for hope is still needed. And if we have hearts at all, we look at the world and we weep, don't we? Afghanistan is just one place in a long line of countries in difficulty. It's a foreign, distant land besieged by military threat and a strict religion. A dangerous place to be for anybody, but particularly if you're a woman or a young child. And it's not the only place in the world where that's true. This weekend is the 9/11 anniversary weekend. 20 years ago that happened. We still watch with horror, don't we, at what terrorism has done. Or we could talk of hunger in the world or military coups, new variants, or all the personal worries that each of us carry to church this morning. So why bother coming to church? Why would you do this? Why do we turn to a story like Esther? What does the story of a Jewish girl who becomes a queen have to do with any of this or you and me? What do we do with a character like Xerxes, which Gordon read to us about, or the hateful Haman? What do we care about the behavior of an old Jew called Mordecai? Well, let me put us all at ease. This is not a book we can handle line by line. What we're interested in is the big sweep of this book of the Bible. The big picture is what we're here for and what we need. And this is why we can turn to any book in the Bible and know that God has put it there to teach us and instruct us and encourage us and show us hope. And that's not just an idea. That's not my preference. That's what God says. Look at this. Everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through the endurance taught in the scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope. That is to be our attitude as we start to read, once upon a time, there was a girl named Esther. And in a world that still needs hope, to people like you and people like me, God has given us his word. So what do we look for as we read the book of Esther together? Let me set the scene this morning. The first thing you'll be glad to hear is not the names or the places of Persia, which we would call Iran today. We're not getting into the nitty-gritty of all the gardens and the banquets that Gordon mentioned to us. There's no need to dissect the significance of the couches or the linen curtains or the quality of the wine. The first thing we need to do is see the really big picture, and it's all about a battle. Maybe you've heard we're studying Esther. Maybe you've been reading ahead. You'll have met Xerxes, the king, and his horrible advisor, Haman. You'll know that Esther is beautiful and attractive. She will become queen of Persia. And she's got this old uncle, Mordecai. And you know that the action centers around Haman, and he hates Mordecai. Let me jump to chapter 3 with you. We'll see that. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, the Jews, he scorned the idea of only killing Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. And that's a lot. That's the 127 provinces we heard about earlier. I'm going to leave that there for a moment. It's quite a leap of logic, isn't it? I hate this one guy, so I'm going to wipe out his entire race. That makes no sense. But it makes perfect sense if we step back and step back and step back and see this as God's word. Haman makes perfect sense if we know Genesis 3:15. In fact, I would encourage you to go home and this week learn by heart Genesis 3:15. It will always keep us right when we're reading our Bibles. It's the key to putting it all together. It's vital for understanding the world you live in. Every preacher of the Bible knows this. So what does it say in Genesis 3:15? Well, God has spoken to Adam and Eve. They've broken the rule. And then he says this to the serpent. I will put enmity, suspicion, hatred, war between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. Now, that's about the one who would defeat the Satan and put everything back in order. That's the battle that the entire Bible tells us about. So Esther is more than Haman hates Mordecai. It's the battle that has raged since the Garden of Eden. Just think with me for a second. It's the baby Moses who's hidden from the tyrannical Pharaoh so that he could do what? Lead his people to freedom. David has to outwit the murderous Saul so that he would become king and the man after God's own heart. Herod does the same thing in Bethlehem, doesn't he? The slaughter of the innocents just to kill one child. The many were killed in order to get the one who threatened his honor and his rule. Doesn't that sound like Haman? Folks, there's a battle that flows through the pages of our Bibles. The one between Haman and Mordecai is just one part of a bigger picture, the bigger picture of Genesis 3:15. And in Esther, we'll see that God will keep this battle going. He will protect his people because the promise to the serpent, he will crush your head, is kept in the death of Jesus Christ. He is the final victory against sin and death and the evil one who encourages them both. There's your hope, and we should watch out for that in Esther's story. We're talking about God. What about God? We said to the children, God's not mentioned in this book. If you've been reading ahead, you may have noticed this. Where is God? Where is God in the book of Esther? That's a great question, because it's only one of two books in the Bible that don't mention God by name. The other one's Song of Songs. We could spend a long time talking about this. Why is God not named in the book of Esther? But Alistair Begg has cut through all the noise and the nonsense of that question by saying this. Why is God's name not in the book of Esther? God's name is not in the book of Esther because he doesn't want his name in the book of Esther. Isn't that simple? But we're going to be clever and ask another question. Why doesn't God want his name in the book of Esther? I'll tell you. Because like we were saying to the children, God doesn't have to be named to be recognized. God is never absent from the lives of his people. God is present every day with everyday people. And his people recognize him when they see him. That's hard to follow, isn't it? Let me give you an old illustration of that truth. Tell me who this is. Marilyn Monroe, isn't she lovely? We know that instantly, don't we? Did anyone not know that? Unmistakably Marilyn. We need no help spotting who that is. That's Marilyn Monroe. We see her for who she is. Now, Christians instantly recognize God in real life. Something happens, something goes wrong, something goes well. The Christian says, that's God. In Esther chapter 6, we'll come to these words. It's an example of what we're talking about. That night, the king could not sleep. So he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. It was found, recorded there, that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers, who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. Now you might think, well, that's lucky. The king can't sleep. He orders himself a bedtime story. And it just so happens that of all the things that could have been read to him, it's a story of how Mordecai saved his life, Esther's uncle. The whole story turns on this moment. How lucky is that? The Christian reads that passage and says, that's God. Unmistakably, that's God. Do you know what, folks? In the struggles of the world, in the struggles of your home, do not think God is absent. Do not think God has stopped caring for his people. Do not think God has stopped caring for you. There's your answer to the big question, where is God? When we put those two things together, the battle and the sometimes unseen presence of God, we're really talking about providence. Now, before you all shut down and shut off, we need to remind ourselves that this is a major doctrine of the church, the doctrine of providence. It's a beautiful doctrine. Here it is. God, the great creator of all things, does uphold, direct, dispose and govern all creatures, actions, and things from the greatest to the least. He does this by his most wise and holy providence, according to his infallible foreknowledge and the free and unchanging counsel of his own will, to the praise and of the glory of his wisdom, power, justice, goodness, and mercy. What a great God we have. I can sense this. You're thinking, what? In Esther, this means we will see a lot of right place, right time, right person. We might start to think about our free will here, but God's providence and our free will, our decisions, are not opposites. In Esther 1, there are all sorts of happenings. The king throws his banquet. It happens that he's had too much wine. He's in his usual mood. It happens that he's told everyone to drink as much as they like. That is going to have an impact on this story. And then from there, there's this fight between Xerxes and his queen, a lady called Vashti. They have a serious squabble. And the king is furious. And that is the whole setup of chapter 1 for how we meet Esther and how she becomes queen. If it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree. Let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. And here's Esther. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Folks, that is what chapter 1 is really doing. It's getting us started once upon a time. But it's also showing us that the happenings of the story are brought about by God. These things don't just happen. God makes them happen. There are two authors to your story. I think you and I are far too prone to the immediate, the here and the now, aren't we? We see what's in front of us and not much more. We worry about the future because we can't see it. And we can barely imagine something like eternity. The Bible thinks in generations. The Bible thinks in generations. And maybe in reading that, we see the time it took, the generations it took, before the Son of God finally crushed the serpent's head. Do you know, some think of this as very cold and difficult. It's there to confuse you and challenge you. But the doctrine of providence is really a soft pillow to put your head on. All our worries about COVID, the world, our families, ourselves, the church, we can rest them in the presence of God and in the perfect timing of Jesus. The battle is won. God is with us, and God provides in our trouble. That's Esther. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I cannot choose the colors that he weaves steadily. Oft times he weaves sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget he sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and reveal the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. He knows, he loves, he cares. Nothing this truth can dim. He gives the very best to those who leave the choice to him.